Hey there, guys and ghouls.
You're tuned in to Broadcast from the Belfry, a TV-tacular podcast for the morbidly curious. I just made that up.
I don't know what that means, but, you know, I assume I'll figure it out. My name's Sanjay. Sitting in a different state that I still keep forgetting the name of is Georgia. How are you doing today?
It's really embarrassing to be living in Illinois right now, but, you know, it's fine.
And in a different room, on the ones and twos is fact checker slash making me look wrong all the time because I am Hope. Hope, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. You know, just trying to wake up.
Sick, rad, and cool. Yeah, we are recording in the morning for once, which never really happens. So there's a lot of sleepy going on. And I'm also drinking water instead of any alcoholic beverage because I do have my limits. So it's going to be a unique experience for everybody.
I already hate it.
It's fair. I also got eaten alive by bugs like days ago and it keeps just like randomly acting up. So that's a lot of fun in like a hell kind of way.
That's what you get for going outside in the summer. Just don't do it.
Yes, it's not that bad awful. Normally.
It's not fun.
My grandma would always say that bugs are attracted to people from Georgia because we're so sweet. So Hope also is like at a different time went outside and got eaten alive. And it's just proven my grandma right. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's also rainy outside today. It's very nice. It's a very like, rainy, cloudy day.
I'm jealous. So when we first moved here, it rained nonstop for like 2 straight weeks. And our yard was a big swamp, basically.
Nice.
And it hasn't rained since, and I kind of want it to rain, because I'm tired of it being hot all the time, because I don't know if you notice, but I don't like summer, I don't like hot, I don't like daylight, I don't like bugs,
You don't like anything. You like the literal month of October's weather, and that's it. You don't like spring, summer, or winter.
I don't mind winter. Everything's dead in winter, there's no bugs, Everything is, you know, peaceful.
The only thing that I want dead isn't dead in winter, and it's me. Why?
Well, because you're not a bear.
If I could hibernate, man, that'd be sick.
You don't get to hibernate.
I wish, that'd be so nice.
Let me just tell you, I had a stress dream this morning about the coffee shop that I'm not even getting a job at, and that's how my day started.
Hey, but you get to learn how to cup. Cupping is so much fun. I love it.
I already know how to cup.
Yeah, but you can do it better now.
No, we have to teach other people who don't like coffee how to cup.
That's gonna be hard. So for people that aren't big coffee nerds, a cupping is kind of just where you bounce ideas back and forth and pick out specific notes that are in coffees. I don't know if this is good or bad or not, but you saying that something tastes like woody might make someone else think, oh, actually, that's what I was tasting. It's oak specifically. Or like, oh, this tastes sweet. Like, yeah, I think it's actually chocolate. That's the sweetness. Or I think it's fruit. That's the sweetness. Like, oh, yeah, it is fruit. Is it blueberry? Oh, no, it's raspberry. So like being in a group and kind of like bouncing around ideas when you're like doing coffee tastings helps you hone in on what the specific notes are. But if you don't like coffee, period, and you think it all tastes like dirt or mud or whatever, it's pretty hard to get in that mindset.
Especially because the way that you cup coffee is literally putting coffee grounds in water.
Yep.
There is no filter.
No, you pour in the water, you get a dry smell, you break the crust,
mm-hmm.
get a wet smell, taste, and then there's like one more step that I don't remember. It's been like years since I've cupped, but yeah, it's fun.
Well, and then you're supposed to spit it out.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you're not supposed to drink.
It's like wine tasting.
Yeah.
I can't find my notes, so hold on. I thought I was ready.
In the meantime, I got a windshield for my microphone, just like the like sock thing that goes on it, and I'm very excited. Hopefully there's a little bit less ambient noise now. The cats ate the other two that I had, so I had to order a third one. Very exciting. Don't leave your windshields out, kids. Your cats will pull them off of your microphone and eat them.
So Luna, well, we're talking about cats, has been doing this new thing where she sits in front of the front door and just fucking meows at the top of her lungs. She's also wearing her cone, so like every time she turns her head, it's like.
Oh.
So you just like hear all these noises of her like bumping into stuff. And it's just her cone. Oh no! This morning, okay, this morning, I was in the bathroom. So I'm sitting in my vanity in the bathroom, and our bathroom is now giant. So her litter box is in there too, because I was like, people bathroom, yeah, bathroom, cool.
Makes sense.
Good plan.
We all poop together.
So I'm like putting my eyeliner on, and then I just hear this little, and I was like, oh my god, my cat just grunted while she was pooping. It was like disgustingly adorable, and it really just warms my heart.
She's learning from Stu.
I also finished season one of Heroes last night.
That's the... how does season one end, actually? I think hoping I'm talking to somebody about this, trying to figure out where, like, the benchmarks were.
Nathan and Peter exploding in the air.
Peter's also just, like, really busted, and it's really stupid. And I think he only gets more busted at this point, so...
I mean, I like that they at least made it realistic, where this, like, starts happening to people all of a sudden, and they can't control it. But then you have crazy people like, I still don't really understand Siler's power, but...
Do you want me to explain it? Because I think at this point you should, like, you know what his base power is.
Yeah, I know that he's like the clockmaker and he like sees how everything works, but I have a hard time like applying that to what is actually happening and like what he actually does, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so Hope, definitely correct me if I'm wrong here. But, so his base power is telekinesis?
No, the first guy that he killed was the guy that had telekinesis.
Oh, yeah, you're right. No, never mind. So, yeah, his base power was telekinesis, or was understanding how people work. So, yeah. He saw, like, where people's powers come from. Like,
yeah.
What little part of you,
like... In their brain, sort of yeah.
Yeah, so he killed that guy to get a power that lets him access that part of people easier. So
now he's literally a super-powered cannibalistic serial killer.
Yeah, only gets better too, I guess.
So as you said at the end of the last episode we posted, which we recorded like 4 months ago, don't judge us.
Sometimes it do be that way, you know?
Yep. We talked a lot about Lovecraft Country because the trailer had just dropped from HBO and we were really excited about it. Well, it's out now. We are going to talk about Lovecraft Country in the future. So if you are watching it along with us and you want to send us thoughts or comments or questions that you think a giant HP Lovecraft nerd might be able to answer, then you should email them to us. And then we will do like a show coverage episode once it's finished airing and address your questions and comments and thoughts.
Oh no, it's all coming back to me now. Yeah, so I think we're going to talk about a little bit of Lovecraft today. I don't remember. Then yeah, we'll like loop back around at the very end of the show, talk about the like book that Lovecraft Country was based off of, in addition to Lovecraft as a whole. And, like, his works that, like, came after and kind of the influence he's had on literature and movies and blah. So if you have any questions or any thoughts or anything like that, email us at broadcastfromthebelfry@gmail.com and we will respond to you letting you know that we got it. And then we will talk about it at the end of the show, which is, I think it's 10 weeks, maybe?
Yeah, the last episode comes out on October 18th. So we talked about making it our Halloween bonus episode.
I'm very cool with that. I love talking into a microphone, looking at a camera, and then people are like, I also was listening to the words you said while you looked into a camera. And I'm like, oh yes, quiet, the finer things in life.
So get us your questions, comments, thoughts. You can send them episode by episode as you watch if you want. I don't care. I don't have anything better to do. I still don't have a job.
Yeah, it's Georgia great. Will compile them. This is her passion.
If only I got paid for it. Send us your emails or carrier pigeons by Sunday, October 25th. The end.
Sweet. That sounds bueno. We appreciate in advance. We look forward to hearing from you.
Yep. Are you wearing your seatbelt?
I
Are you buckled up?
I am. You, You could say that. I'm buckled of sorts.
Safety first. As we all know, I probably bring up Lovecraft every single episode, but we don't really talk about him that much. So we decided with the premiere of Lovecraft Country, we figured it's probably a good time to talk about who Lovecraft is and discuss some of his mythos. You know, give you a little background. If you're watching Lovecraft Country or if you're just curious, then here you go. This one's for you. Also, if you're really that curious, you should just go listen to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. They should pay me for sending people their way at this point.
That sounds like a long form thing, though. This is a short form overview.
Yeah.
So if you have 18,000 hours.
This podcast has been going for 10, they just had their 10th anniversary. So if you have time to catch up on 10 years of podcasts, I would suggest doing that.
So I don't have 10 good minutes stuff to catch up on my own life. How am I supposed to catch up on 10 years of a show?
Yeah, when I first started listening to them, it was
the late 80s.
I think they'd been going for like, yeah, I started listening like 5 years ago. So like halfway. And it took me, I think, a solid year to catch up.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, 2 years.
Yeah, I don't want to, every time I poop, like, turn on the Lovecraft podcast, because then I know every time I listen to it, it's going to make me poop. Like, I'm going to train myself, and every time I clean or every time I drive, I start listening to the podcast just at home, I'll be like, I gotta drive somewhere, and it's, yeah, it's, that sounds awful, but they're very informative, and I've heard good things from you, so, yeah, if you would like to listen to a lunk, very prestige podcast, you know, a very chef's kiss podcast, go do that.
A higher quality podcast than ours.
Mm-hmm.
The end.
With a much higher budget.
They have a Patreon, so there's that. We'll get there one day.
5 years from now.
So we'll talk about biography stuff today and like mythos, and then when the show is done, we'll talk about that specifically, and then maybe get into the more controversial aspects of Lovecraft's career. What do you remember from all the things I've talked about in the last year? Anything?
Lovecraft, racist, Call of Cthulhu, Eldritch Horror. I want to say syphilis, but maybe I'm not. That's all I got.
Okay, all right. Oh, side note, I just want to add this. The term Lovecraft Country refers to the New England, this like spooky New England landscape that he uses for most of his fiction. It's one of those situations. Stephen King does it too with
Barry.
Like Castle Rock and Shawshank. Like they're all set in this New England area. A lot of the towns are fictional, but they're based upon real locations. Like the name might have been changed a little bit, or he takes aspects of real New England towns. And so if you're from there or you're familiar with it, you can be like, I feel like he's talking about, you know, Portsmouth or whatever, but
yeah, now it's called like Dortsmith or something instead.
Yep.
Or it's like Portsbutt instead of Portsmouth. Yeah, it's one of those things.
Don't we have a big fan that lives in New England?
I don't know where New England is, which Hope and I talked about yesterday, actually, unrelated to this.
We did sort of talk about this, but Maine is in New England. So Tyler lives in New England.
Tyler and Anna, we love you guys. Thank you for being our number one fans. Sorry, seriously. I don't know where you live, technically. I just don't understand why there's, in the United States, we have the entire country, we have the states, and we have, like, geographical regions, like, zero. Zero's in the camera now, like, so cute. We have, like, the Midwest, Pacific Northwest, South, East Coast, and then like New England is seemingly like a subsect of
the Northeast.
Yeah. Why? Literally, is it like a colony thing?
I believe so, because like a lot of the first colonies are in like Connecticut, Vermont, New Hampshire, those places, those are all in New England.
We started talking about it because a YouTuber that I follow is in British Columbia, and I was like,
well, that's in Canada.
Yeah, well, I know that now. But I was like, is British Columbia like New England, where it's like not really a place, but it like is a remnant of another time? And Hope was like, no, like British Columbia is an actual place now, but New England is not an actual place. It's just like a descriptor for a region that used to be an actual place. And I was like, oh, Tay, that makes sense.
Got it. That was one shout out for this episode. Tally it down.
Yep, that's it. If I had an air horn that was like not gonna blow out everyone's ears, I'd use it now. You know, like a gentle like bear, bear, bear.
Use your mouth air horn.
Yep, that's two. If I had a dollar for every time I heard that, let me tell you.
Wikipedia outlines his themes as being forbidden knowledge,
Ooh.
non-human influences on humanity, fate, civilization under threat, the risks of science, religion, superstition, and then, we can throw in race there as being the super controversial one. One of his more famous quotes is from an essay he wrote on supernatural horror in literature. It's a really famous essay within that realm, and it says the oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear, specifically a fear of the unknown. That might not be a direct quote. I might have paraphrased that. I can't remember. My bad.
Yeah, it's close enough of anything.
This is just my opinion, but I think that a lot of his writing kind of reflects that turn of the century fear of the other. It could be expressed as cosmic horror in some of his writing, especially his more mature writing.
Do you think there's a porn parody of H.P. Lovecraft's life named Cosmic Whore?
I hope so.
Okay.
But yeah, so sometimes it's cosmic horror, but I think other times it's just a way of depicting that 20th century colonialism is over. Now, what do we do? Kind of fear. It's this concept of the other that challenged people like Lovecraft with their worldviews, and with him in particular, I think we can start to see that love or that worldview shifting. And if he had lived longer, I'm curious to how he would have grown as a person had he lived longer. Would he have grown away from some of his racist tendencies? I wonder.
Maybe if he lived like 200 years, but here we are.
Don't think it would have taken that. I mean, he died in 30 something,
I always forget that
and
he's kind of like a recent person. In my head,
yeah.
he lived in like the 1700s, like he was on
Nope.
the Mayflower.
He was born August 20th, 1890, which is 130 years ago last week.
Happy birthday.
In Providence, Rhode Island. And he had a really weird childhood, I think. He was born into a wealthy family at first on his
And then they lost it all on the ponies. Don't bet on the ponies, you'll lose everything.
his dad was a traveling salesman, and when Lovecraft was three, his dad had a psychotic episode when he was traveling for work in the hotel room. That's where the syphilis comes in. He probably had syphilis, and he
I
was
knew it.
institutionalized for the rest of his life, and he died 5 years later. So when Lovecraft was eight, and he went into I don't know if this is, I tried to read about it, and I think they just called it a paralytic state, and that was like a euphemism for this person died of syphilis, But a paralytic state also refers to the other things that can happen. So I think that they really sheltered Lovecraft from the fact that his father died of syphilis. So,
Yeah, also you saying that you tried to read about it makes me think that you like forgot how to read. Like you had the like article pulled up in front of you, and then you're just like, what are these glyphs?
but
Like I don't
no,
know what's happening.
yesterday. So I had to go to the DMV yesterday, right? Because I had to get my license and get new plates for my car and register to vote.
That sounds lame
And
and expensive.
yeah, I spent $300 just on my freaking plates, and I didn't get to get my license because I forgot my social security card like an idiot.
Stupid.
So, and it's like a 30-minute drive to get to the DMV, by the way. But like my tags expired this month, so I was like, well, I got the important thing done, so that's fine. I just need to like get on that so I can register to vote, because, God forbid I don't freaking vote this year.
Make sure you vote, kids. Vote in
Yeah,
2020.
PSA.
If you don't vote, you'll get syphilis. That's a fact.
And then you'll die of a paralytic state.
Exactly.
Anyway, I'm picturing that I have to go get my, you know, license picture done and everything. So I tried real hard on my makeup yesterday, and sometimes my mind wanders into weird places when I'm doing this. I came out of the bathroom and Stu was sitting on the couch, and I just went, "Do you remember learning to read?" And he was like, "No." And I was like, "Me neither." And I feel like this is something I really take for granted. But then I was like, maybe people who are just, you know, good at reading don't have that, like, struggle when they're younger about learning how to read. So you don't remember it. It just was, like, one of those things that was easy for me. So I don't remember, like, struggling with words or, like, letters or anything. But if I did, I would have remembered it. But I was like, I just feel like I've always been able to read. I don't know. Is that a thing?
I feel like you're right. And it's just, like, if it's easy, if it comes naturally to you, then it's not, like, a formative memory. But if you struggled with it, then it was. Because, like, I remember not knowing my left and my right when I was a kid. Like, that was a big thing, was that, like, I could not figure out my left and my right. So, like, I still remember that, even though it was 20 years ago. But I don't remember learning how to read. And I remember, like, when I was 10, I remember always having books with me. And I remember, like, reading in, like, different places. Like, when my mom was, like, doing mom stuff or whatever. One of my sisters were doing whatever their thing was. So, yeah, I have, like, memories of reading, but not memories of learning how to read. But also, when do you learn how to read? Like, second grade?
I have pictures of me before I started school reading. So, I think that was one of those things that, like, I got started early on, you know? Like,
and now my mom has a nerd. Wow.
Don't teach your kids to read. Unless you want them to be giant nerds.
Exactly. Illiteracy is the new hip, cool thing.
Lovecraft goes to live with his mom and her parents and her two sisters. So he grew up with his maternal grandfather as his only father figure, really, because he was in a house with all these women. And his grandfather also traveled for work a lot, so they corresponded through letters. Oh, speaking of reading, HP could read and write at the age of 3.
Probably really early, as we just established. Actually, wait, Hope, can you look up when the average person learns how to read? This is literally why we have fact check here.
Yeah, I just looked it up. The average children learn to read around 6 or 7, but some learn as early as 4 or 5. And then there's H.P. Lovecraft, apparently.
Showing us up.
Sweet. Thank you.
So, listen to this. His grandfather's name was Whipple von Buren Phillips.
That's a fake name. A dumb name and a fake name.
It sounds like a character that Leonardo DiCaprio would play.
Probably, and not win an Oscar for.
Yeah, like in one of his, you know, newer movies.
What movie did he actually win an Oscar for? It wasn't Hateful Eight, it wasn't a Django Unchained. It was after that.
It was.
Oh, it was The Revenant. Never mind.
I was like, it was that one where he was cold.
Yeah, that's the, like, one of his movies that I have not watched because I just don't think I care. It like did not seem interesting at all. But he won an Oscar.
Yeah, if it was actually about a Revenant. And there was, like, a zombie thing in it. That'd be cool, but I don't think that's what it's about.
No, I think
the name is very misleading.
I think it's, like, that movie where James Franco, like, eats his hand, but, like, in the cold.
Anyway, Whipple von Buren Phillips.
Fake name von fake name.
It's from this guy that HP learns his appreciation of both classical literature as well as weird fiction. And then when he was 6, his grandmother died. And so he's in the house with his grandfather and his mom and his 2 aunts. I don't know if you remember, but around Christmas time, we talked about Victorian mourning dress and all the asbestos and God knows what else. And he had nightmares about that. Like, and he had nightmares influenced by this Victorian-esque mourning wear. I think that was childhood trauma that kind of contributed to his imagination, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And the household never really was the same after that. It was probably kind of depressing all the time. And it's probably here that his fear of death stems from and why he writes a lot about that kind of topic. At age 7, he's writing poetry that emulates the Greek epics, like the Odyssey that we talked about the other day. And he has already decided that God is a myth comparable to Santa Claus.
Okay.
Then at age 8, he has discovered his love for chemistry and astronomy. And by age 12, he's writing his own scientific journals. And then in 1904, he is, yeah, what were you doing at 12?
Yeah, exactly. I was I was here. I was in Kansas, so probably not too much.
I was in England. It's great. 1904, he is 14. His grandfather's business ultimately fails. They lose most of their money. And then his grandfather dies of a stroke.
Ooh,
and
for me, dog.
Yeah, so then 14, he goes to live with his mom in a duplex. They have a small inheritance left over, but not a lot, and it's one of those things where they really have to ration it out to make it last.
And he has to get a job, probably.
He makes a little bit of money off of his writings, but and I don't know if she would have had a job or not.
Probably not, right?
Well, she was also here. She was also eventually institutionalized, probably because she also probably had syphilis from her husband.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess he liked to pick up some night ladies when he was traveling for the biz, you know?
Ladies of the night and night ladies are completely different energy, and I don't appreciate that. You guys are also missing hot dog playing with Hope's headphone. It is very cute.
Yeah, it's real cute. Yeah, so he went to live with his aunts after his mom was institutionalized. He ended up not even finishing high school. He had a lot of, like, mental breakdowns that made him miss, like, big chunks of school. A lot of, you know, mental issues in his family and all of the deaths and institutionalizations that were going on. People have since diagnosed him as probably having atypical depression. And so he grew up in the stereotypical wealthy elitist white New England family with extremely Anglophilic influences from his father, who was so much an Anglophile that people thought he was actually from Britain. And if you read a lot of original Lovecraft manuscripts, you'll notice he uses British spellings or like British terminology for words. But and then
he just had big PPs for the old country.
Yeah, and I think that ended up becoming an influence on his belief system. Part of his problem with immigrants, he especially hated German and Irish immigrants, and he believed that they bastardized the English language, like slang, accents, colloquialisms.
I think I also hate the Irish accent, but that's different. I don't hate Irish people. I just, like, they're... I don't know. When I was in high school, people would be like, "Hey, oi, I'll bash your fucking head," and like that really just has left a bad taste in my mouth.
Maybe you just hate people faking terrible Irish accents.
That is probably actually more accurate in hindsight. Yeah.
He does have this reputation of being an agoraphobe, but I feel like this might not be accurate. He traveled extensively throughout the East Coast throughout his entire life. He would take buses as far north as Quebec and as far south as Key West, and then as far west as Cleveland. So he traveled the main chunk of the Eastern Seaboard there, and he would just visit all of the people that he wrote letters to, his writing friends. And you could tell he was cheap because he would book his tickets for overnight, so he didn't have to pay for a hotel, and he would just sleep on the bus.
Nice. That's
which is smart. I mean, I do that with airplanes sometimes. Like, if I have to fly somewhere, I'll just book a red eye, A, because it's cheaper, and B, because I'm like, oh, I can just sleep on the plane and then I'm good to go when I get there.
Yeah, none of this has ever occurred to me because I hate traveling in the morning. I hate traveling, actually, but I like going places, so maybe I should just like try to do it that way. That would make sense. Oh.
And then you have more time at your actual destination, too.
Mm-hmm.
By now, it's 1920. Well, he traveled throughout his life, but, you know, to backtrack, it's 1920. He has already written a ton of short stories. A lot of them might not have been published at that time. At this time, he starts writing the first things that become associated with the Cthulhu mythos, which was a term coined after he died by August Derleth, who we'll talk about later. He's a crazy dude. And this is when we see the first excerpts of the Necronomicon as well, which we have talked about in an entire episode about the Necronomicon. I think that was like episode 11 or 12-ish, somewhere in there.
I remember talking about the Whitest Kids You Know nail gun skit, so I know we've talked about the Necronomicon, but I don't remember exactly the episode.
It was one of our very early ones. That which is dead can eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death may die. That's one of the most famous lines from the Necronomicon.
Ooh-woo.
To reiterate, the Necronomicon is a fictional book. It is not real. People have written books and called it the Necronomicon, and those exist. But the Necronomicon itself does not exist, and it is not real. Evangelical Christians who preach about it need to read a real book instead of preaching about a fake one.
Yeah, Necronomicon's not real. Do you know what is real? The Junie B. Jones series. And if that doesn't haunt your nightmares, then I don't know what should, honestly. The B stands for better get your crucifix and stake, because there's a lot of unnatural stuff going on. That's the entire name of the book. Good. I guess that's the entire first page.
So in 1924, he marries Sonia Green, who was actually Jewish, fun fact. And they live in New York, and he fucking hates it.
He hates her, or like, he hates living in New York, or he hates being married. I guess there's a lot of different...
He hates living in New York, but this is, like, the only time, probably, that he eats really well since he left his rich lifestyle behind. He said he put on, like, 40 pounds from her cooking or something.
Oh, dang.
I mean, he's known for being, like, a gangly human, so... It's during this time that he writes Call of Cthulhu, which is probably his most famous piece of writing. And it was his first true Lovecraftian piece. In one of his letters, he wrote, I have my Poe pieces and I have my Dunsany pieces, but where are my Lovecraft pieces? Because he hadn't really like found, you know, he knew how to emulate other writers, but he hadn't really found his own like writing style at that point. And so Call of Cthulhu was kind of his first original Lovecraftian piece of work. So I love that story. It's so good.
Hope it's also just read it for the first time like 3 days ago.
It's an early example of a found document horror, which is a trope that is used a lot today, you know, like Blair Witch Project, Cloverfield, it's used a lot in movies, you know, found tapes. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of cool because it's like a found document within found document. It's like one of those Russian dolls of found document horrors. Did you know that Cthulhu is a great priest?
What?
Yeah, Cthulhu's a priest. He is one of the great old ones. In his house at Rillier, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming. He does get references in other Lovecraft works. He is a human octopus dragon hybrid with webbed arms, tentacles, and some kind of crappy wings, but he's hundreds of feet tall.
That sounds like a mind flayer, actually. A mind flayer with dragon aspects that's really very, very tall. As opposed to, like, the amorphous spaghetti dude that I think of when I hear Cthulhu, and when I think of Cthulhu specifically. Not the Stranger Things mind flayer, like the D&D mind flayer.
Which is supposed to be the Stranger Things mind flayer, but not really. I guess because they just call it that, because they don't know what else to call it.
Hope, isn't there a specific reason why they call it a mind flayer, but they don't use the imagery of, like, D&D lore for it?
Yeah, it was something like they just wanted it to look cooler and more, like, theatric. Also, I've been looking this whole time. Episode 9 was when we talked about the Necronomicon. And also, as someone who did just read Call of Cthulhu for the first time, I would like to say that Cthulhu did nothing wrong. He was just hanging out at his house. Yep. And he got made into a monster for no reason.
And all of a sudden, this fucking ship just appears out of nowhere, and he's like, hey, intruders, what are you doing?
Yeah, he was just protecting his home.
And yep. Now everyone's so. Like, he's a monster, blah, blah, blah. Get out of my face, dude.
But yep. As usual, it's the humans that are the monsters.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Look at his little paws.
I know.
Hot Dog is doing the most, being super cute right now.
Yep. He's purring so much.
Real cute. Yeah, human octopus dragon hybrid. Webbed arms, tentacles. We'll talk more about pop culture, of course, later. But my favorite Cthulhu interpretation I've seen in a while is probably in South Park. Have you seen that episode? It's one of the Coon and Friends. It's one of those episodes. There is also a new echinoderm discovered. It's like a sea cucumber type thing, and they named it after Cthulhu. It's called Celestina Cthulhu.
I really wish that I was a scientist just so I could name stuff. I think I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, but there's like a set of like vertebrae that are named after Sega characters because of like the team that found or discovered them, or like discovered these bundles of nerves, were all really big nerds. So there's like a sonic nerve or like a sonic bone in your body. It's pretty solid.
So I think maybe his time in New York gave him an idea of what it meant to be an outsider, and that might have contributed to what could potentially be him growing as a person. So anyway, their marriage doesn't last very long. They get separated by the time he moves back to Providence in 1926. We're already in the last 10 years of his life, which is kind of sad. This is also his most prolific writing period, and a lot of his, you know, like really famous key pieces of weird fiction come out of this. By the time he died, he corresponded with 97 people via letters.
Dang.
He was saving the post office. And sometimes he would go without food so he could afford the postage to send all of his letters.
Aw, that's so sweet.
Like,
but like also not healthy.
Yeah, not healthy at all. He already didn't really eat very well anyway. He lived off of coffee, usually old coffee. He would walk to the convenience store and take a bucket with him, and he would just like fill that up with coffee and then just take it home, and that's what he would, that's how he got his coffee. Hey. He would eat like half a tin of beans, and that would be an entire meal. Yeah, he did not eat very much, and the food that he did eat was like not very wholesome, especially at that time. Yeah, he might have had this tin of beans in his cabinet for 5 years, which would be okay now, but because preservatives back then weren't what they are today, they were probably already not great condition for eating. So 1926, he was supposed to get divorced, but he never actually signed the papers. So his wife ended up marrying someone else. So she technically broke the law, even though she didn't mean to, because of him.
Crime.
Yeah. Pickman's Model came out of 1926, which is another great story about an artist who paints these like really violent demonic scenes, demons eating people at a graveyard, or demons eating people at a underground train wreck or something.
At a TGI Fridays.
Also that. The horrors that he paints from real life instead of his imagination. Shocker.
The biggest demons are inside of us. Remember that, kids.
It's true. Also in 1926, he wrote Cool Air, which I think is ultimately a piece about the fear of dying. It's about a guy who, he was a doctor, and then he became obsessed with trying to preserve himself. And he's basically already been dead for decades, but he has kept his body alive. And his apartment is like really cold all the time, but the power goes out in the city. And so his cooling devices all don't work, and he basically melts. And his neighbor is like trying to help him.
I was hoping that Cool Air was a prequel or sequel to Cool Runnings, but there does not seem to be mention of a Jamaican bobsled team anywhere in this
work. So Cuba Gooding Jr. was the neighbor, though.
Ooh, okay, nice. Good, I'm glad it all ties together.
1927, the next year, we have The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, which is just an acid trip. I don't even know how to paraphrase this story or describe any of it. It's space language floating from space to I don't know how to put it into words. Much cosmic, very weird.
Okay, sweet.
And then in 1927 is also the case of Charles Dexter Ward, which I know I've talked about at least a couple times before. One of his longer stories. It's one of my personal favorites. It's another supernatural interpretation of fear of death. It's the one, I know I told you this before, the guy is bringing back corpses to interrogate them, and it low-key implies that one of them is Ben Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
It's that one. Guy becomes a wizard, and he kind of condenses a person to an essence in order for them to be immortal, and then they can, like, go from body to body, and this guy's ancestor comes back in his essence form and then replaces the guy and tries to steal his identity, basically.
That doesn't sound right. That sounds like Ex Machina. Spoilers, I guess, but new or older? Way older. Way more spooky. Way more mythical, actually. Ex Machina still might have been spookier.
This is really off topic, but I went outside last night. Sistu was messing around in the garage and I was going through Facebook, and then I got my NPR notification and I put my phone down and I walked outside and I just looked at him and I said, "Did you see that Black Panther died?" And he just goes, "What?"
Oh yeah, it has been less than 24 hours. It's actually probably been around like 12-ish hours at this point.
Yeah.
But yeah, Chadwick Boseman died yesterday, and it has been such a rough 24 hours.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even like that much of a Marvel, you know, nerd, but I was still just like, "What? T'Challa?"
Yeah, he died of colon cancer. And like,
yeah.
I called one of my like friends that's a really big Marvel fan and was like, "Hey, if you didn't know, I need you to know." And her mom had just sent her an article. And I guess she said the same thing when she got that article that I did when I first got the notification, which was, "But how could he save Wakanda when his colon was messed up? How could he?"
I know.
I just,
because when that movie came out in 2017 and he's had colon cancer since 2016. And I was like, what?
Yeah. And like the Marvel like workout regimen is insane. Yeah. So like he would have had to been pushing his body to the limit like every day to stay in shape for that.
And it's, dang. Mm-hmm. Then he comes back and all the, he's in like Endgame and everything too, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't Marvel, I'm sorry.
He is. He's in like all of the team up movies in addition to,
yeah,
like standalone. Hot Dog is really wanting to be part of the podcast right now.
Speaking of Boseman. In 1927, we also get The Color Out of Space. And The Color, interestingly, is categorized as one of the great old ones, even though it's not corporeal being. It's just literally a color. Did you see that movie?
No, did not.
So it came out at the end of last year. Nicolas Cage is the main character.
Hmm. I was going to ask why I would have seen it, and that actually makes sense, yes.
I think Hope and I also talked about it in the group chat, or like shared an article or something. It's supposed to be the first of a trilogy that they're making, hopefully, which still happens. Nicolas Cage, honestly, I know he's hate to love, love to hate actor.
He could eat a peach for hours. And but I think that's important.
His ability to go from like normal to batshit crazy in a nanosecond makes him the perfect actor to play a Lovecraft antagonist, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The movie adapts it, obviously, so it's not quite the same as the story. But in the story, this meteor lands in the well of this farm, and all these crazy life forms start to grow on the farm, and then there's like weird obsessions with things in the well. It's a farmer and his wife and their like two or three kids, and the things on the meteor destroy the farm, and now it's like there's nothing left of it. And the story is told from the perspective of a friend who like frequently came back to check in on the family, specifically the farmer. It's really set, it has that Stephen King element to it. He's dealing with the real tragedy of like watching his wife go insane and watching his kids suffer because of everything that's happened because of this meteor, but then also the supernatural horror of it all about the meteor itself. So the movie adaptation takes it a step further, and Nicolas Cage just bought this farm and he moves his family out of the city onto this farm, and they're going to start, you know, living this organic lifestyle. His wife has cancer, and I think that was like the motivation to move out of the city. So that's more of that real world tragedy. She's dealing with cancer, struggling, like her kids are trying to figure out how to deal with that aspect of mortality, watching their mom be really sick. Then the meteor happens and shit gets real crazy. Because in the book, it's just described like the wife goes crazy and one of the kids suffers really hard, but it doesn't really go into it that much. It just says that he ended up locking them in the attic. The way the movie depicts it, I don't want to spoil it because it's just shocking when you actually see it happen. But I would highly recommend watching that.
I would like to.
In 1928, the Dunwich Horror came out.
The Donuts Horror.
The Dunwich Horror. I'm so sick of hearing about donuts. Oh my god.
Yeah, that's a weird beef.
Dunwich Horror is about this mysterious pregnancy from this woman. She has these two kids that are always locked away. One of them's real creepy and smells weird, and the other's basically just a giant invisible blob who is kept under control by, I think, the grandfather, but then the grandfather dies. There's also, like, maybe some implications that he's a wizard and also had sex with his daughter to produce these two offsprings. It's not real clear.
Just sounds like a lot.
Yeah, the tall, stinky one breaks into a library to steal something. He ends up getting eaten by dogs, I think. And then the main part of the story is about the Dunwich Horror itself is the giant invisible brother who goes on like a rampage, just destroying shit across town. And the townspeople have to stop him.
Because his brother's dead. He's just like, porque. That makes sense.
Dunwich Horror is 1928, and then Whisper in Darkness doesn't come out till 1931, and I think in the, like, three-year gap there, one of his aunts got sick, and so he... Because remember, I'm pretty sure he still lived with his aunts again, and he spent a lot of time taking care of one of his sick aunts. So there's a gap, then Whisper in Darkness comes out. We are introduced to the Mego, which are creepy little alien insects, and they harass this dude. They're not great old ones. I don't really know where they fall into in the mythos scheme, but they're like alien insect assistants, maybe like a precursor to something else that comes along eventually. But they harass this dude, and eventually they put his brain in a jar and steal his body. Crazy story. You get a lot of the story told through letters back and forth between the guy whose brain gets stolen and a professor from Miskatonic, of course, which is Lovecraft's fictional university where a lot of his professors are from.
Oh, it's like DeVry, but it's not DeVry.
It's not at all. And then also in 1931, we get The Mountains of Madness, which is one of his longer stories and one of his more famous ones. Very The Thing-ish. You get explorers from Miskatonic. They go to the South Pole to explore. They find remnants of an Elder Things civilization that's built by... So the Elder Things basically create the Shoggoths as kind of a slave race. I guess they're made. Maybe I'm picturing like how the orcs like come out of pods and they're all gross.
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
I think that in the first episode of Lovecraft Country, that maybe at the end, I think those might be supposed to be Shoggoths, because Atticus like goes up to the woods and he mentions Shoggoths, so I don't know if that's what they're supposed to be, or do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think you do. Like the are you referring to the creatures or to the like bipeds?
The creatures, yeah, with the teeth and the tarry werewolf kind of things. I don't know.
Maybe I like going into episode two. I think we get confirmation that that's not what they are, but that he does reference it. I am not 100% sure, though. Hope, do you remember?
I do not, but I was going to look it up.
Sweet. Thank you.
Cool. We'll talk more about this in our, you know, episode show coverage, but I thought the scariest part of the episode was when they were running from that diner and then they met that cop in the woods and he was like, you know what a sundown town is? And I was like shitting my pants. I was like, oh my god, you guys gotta go. Mm-hmm. That was terrifying. You know, and then
like levels of spooky.
God. Like the real world horror was definitely more terrifying than the supernatural horror.
Mm-hmm. What did you think those were called?
Ah! That was my mic falling over.
Okay. Yeah, that is what they are.
Oh, okay. Sweet.
Yeah.
Thank you, Hope, for the fact checking.
The Shoggoths are made to kind of do the bidding of the Elder Thing civilization. It's implied that all life on Earth was created by what was left over from the Shoggoths, which I thought was really interesting. They find evidence as they're exploring of a massive conflict, supposedly with the Star Spawn of Cthulhu, but we don't really know what that is. I think that's maybe its own character within the mythos, but it doesn't really come up anywhere else. And then there's a ton of dead Elder Things, and the horror is like, well, what's so terrifying that it would massacre all of these other terrifying creatures? There, so I don't know if it was fish. Like...
Remember that.
Yeah.
Gone to 20-something. 2001, maybe? Yeah.
Or it could be, maybe there was a Shoggoth uprising, and they were like, you know what? I'm fucking tired of this shit. Let's kill the overlords and
do what
make our own creatures.
Let's open a Denny's franchise. That's all Shoggoths want. Just real mediocre food, but, you know, great prices. Shout out to Denny's.
I would argue that there are some influences
of Denny's.
Mm-hmm. So The Thing, it was an adaptation of a story called Who Goes There, which was written by John Campbell in 1938. But I would argue that that was influenced by The Mountains of Madness. Just that it's a cold South Pole setting. There's something terrible out there lurking, trying to escape with us. I also read a thing that I thought was really funny. It builds terror the same way that Alien does, and Alien was called the best Lovecraftian film ever made without being a Lovecraft adaptation.
Really?
Just because of the way that the tension builds up.
I guess. Yeah, I guess.
And so, like, all these weird things start happening and you don't really know. I mean, they're very different settings, but essentially the same thing is happening. You have this mysterious creature that you don't really know what it is. And The Thing, I think it's invisible, so that it's more like a virus in The Thing. In Alien, it's obviously a parasitic, giant, creepy thing. But either way, they're basically trying to survive pretending to be one of these other people long enough to make it back to civilization where they can just dominate, kill everyone, and take over.
You know, so the alien dream. Slash the American dream, actually. Mostly the American dream.
Hey, they only stole it from the British Empire.
No.
So, yeah, I thought that was a fun fact. In 1931, we also get Shadow over Innsmouth, which is probably his second most famous story after Call of Cthulhu. This is where the Esoteric Order of Dagon shows up, and they're involved with the Deep Ones. I think that this is the kind of vibe that Lovecraft Country is giving up. Basically, in A Shadow over Innsmouth, a guy gets stuck in this town, and there's a cult that offers human sacrifices to the Deep Ones, who are some aquatic race that have been planning to use the Shoggoths to kind of rebuild the world for them. I mean, there's lots of cults in Lovecraft. There's also another short story, one of his earlier short stories, called, I think, The Holiday.
That doesn't sound scary at all.
Yeah, it's about this guy, and he goes back to visit his ancestral home or something, and he meets some of his distant relatives. They are like, oh yeah, we're going to, oh, it's called The Festival, that's what it is. We're going to this festival later, you want to come with us? And he's like, okay, sure. And basically, they just wanted to sacrifice him. So I think those two stories definitely have, like, some influence over how Lovecraft Country was written, and they have those vibes of, oh, you're our ancestor, we need you for this, like, ceremonial rite. You're so important, your bloodline is super important, but they just want to sacrifice him, so.
So
we'll see, I guess.
You saying the name of that last, like, work reminded me, so in bringing it back to magic, always, in Magic the Gathering, there's two kind of, like, not explicitly Eldritch sets, but, like, kind of, like, of that
I
nature.
I think I have something about magic in my notes later, too.
Yeah. There's specifically a card that, like, this just reminded me of from, like, the latter of which is, like, just straight up. It's, the card's name is Elder Deep Fiend, and I was, like, just never put two and two together. But
oh,
is,
the Deep Ones, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a, like, weird, like, Kraken-y, side mouth, asymmetrical eye. Definitely inspired by that, so.
The Deep Ones themselves are hard to describe, but the story is supposed to be some kind of, like, warning against inbreeding, which could suggest racist tones, but I also interpret it as more of an incest thing in my mind, because part of the story is that, like, if you are from this town, or if, like, your ancestors are from this town at some point in your life, you're going to have this instinctual feeling to return there. And you might not do it on purpose. Like I said, this guy was passing through and ended up getting stuck there. And he ends up succumbing and he never returns to his normal life. He stays in this town and, like, becomes a Deep One breeder, whatever they're called. And so I'm like, okay, well, if your ancestors are from there and they're all, like, coming back here to breed, isn't that kind of an incest thing? That was just that's how my mind interprets it. But the scholastic interpretation is it's don't breed with black people. Mm. Yeah. I think I've said this a couple episodes ago, but he was friends with Robert E. Howard, who actually killed himself around this time as well. And he took that really hard. Mm. And that was so sad.
His only friend. Or I guess he has 96, like, correspondences. At least three of those were probably friends as well. But
one of them was Robert Bloch. And actually, I'm just going to talk about this real quick. His last story that he ever wrote was Hunter of the Dark. And he wrote that at the end of 1935. And it's a reaction kind of sequel to a story that Robert Bloch wrote called The Shambler from the Stars. And the protagonist of Hunter of the Dark is named Robert Blake. So it's kind of like a nod to the fact that he wrote this. Bloch writes another sequel to Lovecraft's sequel to his sequel.
That sounds
called The Shadow from the Steeple. I know, it's super meta. And I think that one has like a Lovecraft-themed protagonist who goes looking for Robert Blake. But that didn't get published till 1950, after Lovecraft was already dead. But I thought it was cute banter. Robert Bloch was the one who wrote Psycho. Fun fact.
Oh.
Okay. I think I've talked about him before. He also wrote the episode of Star Trek with the giant cat.
I don't know if that was mentioned or not, because I feel like I would have wanted to watch that one episode of Star Trek, that specific episode of Star Trek.
Original Star Trek, yeah.
OG.
So, Og Trek. Mm-hmm. He died on the Ides of March, March 15th, in 1936. Aw.
Yep.
So many people die that day.
She knows.
He was 46. He had renal failure and cancer of the small intestine. He was so scared of doctors that he was so sick the last couple years of his life, but he didn't go to the doctor until a month before he died because of how scared he was of death and all the things he experienced in childhood.
Me with dentists, like, I could literally have, like, a knife stuck in my teeth, like, or, like, a knife stuck in my, like, gums, and I wouldn't see a dentist. I'd
just deal with it. No thanks.
Yep.
Other notable characters from the mythos. Sathag, who was created by Clark Ashton Smith, who was part of this like writers club that he had. He is an old one, introduced in 1929, who is basically a giant ugly toad, and he has a couple bat-like elements. Michael Shea is an author who uses Sathagua for some of his stories, and you know how I told you Patton Oswalt is in the H.P. Lovecraft literary podcast as a guest every once in a while?
Yeah.
He always comes on to talk about Michael Shea's stories because he pays that like $200 Patreon tier, so he gets to pick what they talk about once a quarter, and so that's what he always picks.
Nice.
Then we have Haster, who is another great old one, supposed to be a floating mass of tentacles and suckers. Some people think he's a half-brother to Cthulhu, and he is also a character called the King in Yellow from a Robert Chambers story who influenced Lovecraft as well. He would disguise himself as kind of a hobo. Haster is also, I don't know if you remember in Good Omens, but there's like the Dukes of Hell.
Nope.
They're the ones who are always going after Crowley, who are like,
yes,
you're not doing your job. And one of those is Haster, so that's a fun fact. Shub-Niggurath is also an outer god, the black goat of the woods with 1,000 young, who was like introduced by HP and then expanded upon by August Derleth and Robert Bloch. And August Derleth is dumb. He's the one that published all of H.P. Lovecraft's work posthumously, which would have probably killed him all over because he was such a perfectionist that he only published things that he thought were like completely finished. Mm-hmm. But Derleth published all these stories that were never meant to be published, which is, I think, why Lovecraft gets such a bad rap at being a bad writer, because Derleth published a bunch of things that weren't supposed to be published, and he published all of his letters and stuff like that. Anyway, yeah, he sucks. But it's also because of him that a lot of Lovecraft's work survived the middle part of the 20th century. So the Black Goat of the Woods with 1,000 young, she shows up in the Call of Cthulhu RPG and is classified as an outer god. Nyarlathotep is also an outer god who first appears in 1920. He's described as looking kind of like an ancient pharaoh, but it seems that he can change his appearance, shapeshifter style. He shows up in a lot of Lovecraft stories in one shape or form. He's used by Robert E. Howard, Robert Bloch, August Derleth, even Lynn Carter, who wrote Conan after Robert E. Howard died, shows up in other stories as well. I think I've mentioned before that he was supposed to be Randall Flagg in The Stand by Stephen King.
Yeah.
He was also maybe a servant of Azathoth, who was a ruler of the outer gods and symbolized primordial chaos.
That sounds pretty
and then cool. Derleth publishing all that stuff probably helped keep his work around. And then the Call of Cthulhu game kind of made his work mainstream again. So like a couple of nerds got together, wrote an RPG, and were like, cool, this is awesome. And then other nerds were like, this is cool. And then all the 80s movie producers were like, let's make terrible low-budget movies based on Lovecraft's work.
He's dead. How's he gonna complain? It's fine.
But that's kind of what has kept him resurrected and has, like, brought back this resurgence of his work in the last 20 years or so. And then it also helps that, like, Stephen King, Guillermo del Toro, Neil Gaiman, Terry Pratchett, all inspired very obviously by Lovecraft, Clive Barker, Mike Mignola. Do you know who that is?
Nope.
He wrote Hellboy.
Oh, cool.
And then John Carpenter, like I said, with The Thing. Stuart Gordon, he was one of the directors who made some of the terrible 80s movies. But they're still really fun to watch. Like, I watched some of those with my dad. There's one called Reanimator, which was based on Herbert West's Reanimator, which was a story about kind of a Frankenstein-type character. He died earlier this year, too. So RIP Stuart Gordon. Let's just keep talking about people we like who died. All right, pop culture. This is hard because Lovecraft is so permeated into pop culture, especially, like, our kind of pop culture, our nerdiness. So I'm just going to hit the highlights. Ton of movie adaptations. Like I said, most of them are terrible. The Nicolas Cage Colorado Space is the only one that's come out recently that's probably actually tried and, like, had a decent budget. Then we have the Arkham Horror board game, Call of Cthulhu RPG. Pre-Wizards of the Coast D&D referenced the mythos in Deities and Demigods, but they had to make changes to avoid a lawsuit from Chaosium of, like, the Call of Cthulhu. I can't remember who had D&D before it was Wizards of the Coast, but whoever owned the rights to D&D before. The Eldrazi, do you know what that is?
Yeah, they're...
In Magic?
Yeah, they're interdimensional space beings that do... that are... Yeah. They just are Cthulhu. Like, they are very Eldritch-based. They are cool. Native to Zendikar, but are, like, the image that I sent, like, is an Eldrazi horror. So for those two sets, they, like, specifically were like, okay, we're gonna, like, I guess just the latter of the sets, like, we're gonna figure out a way to incorporate this into, like, late 1800s, early 1900s, like, low fantasy, like, sci-fi setting, which is pretty cool.
Nice. Soul Eater, I didn't realize this, but in Soul Eater, you've seen Soul Eater, right?
Yeah.
Still my favorite anime. The black mass that comes out of the book is supposed to be a reference to Cthulhu, apparently.
Okay.
Cool. The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, I know that's your favorite show.
It's very good. It's very high quality, and it's very everything that it should be, yes.
References the old ones, the deep ones, Eldritch Terrors. And then season 3 specifically references some other influence of Lovecraft with that guy ends up being Pan. There's a story called The Great God Pan, which is written by Arthur Machen, who was an author that influenced Lovecraft as well. And listen, this one blew my mind. So the Christmas special in Doctor Who, the Victorian one, the snowmen. So I guess that the snowmen are a reference to, well, the great intelligence, I guess, is a reference to Yog-Sothoth. So it suggested that what was actually possessing Simeon is Yog-Sothoth, because as a deity, he is supposed to be all-knowing. I thought that was really interesting, and I pooped my pants a little bit. Yog-Sothoth and Cthulhu both show up in The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy.
That sounds right. Yeah, I was actually thinking if Nurgle was a Eldritch being, but he's Slender Man, so... Not really, but he also does, like, open up his chest and, like, tentacles come out and, like, black masses. Cool. So I feel like he's a combination of both, but...
Yeah.
Yep.
I was waiting for you to scrape and lick, but you didn't do it.
I did not. Not this time. This isn't about Dracula. This is about Nurgle.
Scooby-Doo, Mystery Inc. This pisses me off. The character's name is H.B. Hatecraft.
Nice.
And I hate it. And they go to Miskatonic University... And H.B. Hatecraft is kind of a douche.
That sounds right.
Okay, here. So, like I said earlier, South Park, the goth kids turn out to be part of the Cult of Cthulhu. And the reason Kenny is always resurrected for the next episode is because his mom was a part of a Cult of Cthulhu ritual when she was pregnant with him.
I didn't know they ever actually explained that. That's a very interesting way to look. Well,
because there's this episode, it's when Cartman is, like, in his coon outfit, and he's like, Cthulhu's been summoned, and he's chilling in the ocean, and then Cartman is just, like, sitting on him, talking to him, and that's the only part I really remember, but I always thought it was kind of funny. In Supernatural, there's a Lovecraft who is killed after opening a door to purgatory, and you eventually find out that the Leviathan are supposed to be old ones. I really hated that season, so I kind of probably blanked it out a little bit. Moral of the story is keep Borax in your home. The Necronomicon's not real. Don't summon demons if you don't know how to get rid of them. The end. That's all I got.
What is your favorite of these pop culture references / what's your favorite pasta dish? Hope it makes sense. He's spaghetti. He's a spaghetti monster.
Alfredo is my favorite pasta dish. The end. But I love all pasta. All pasta is good.
Whatever the chungus noodles are that are full of cheese, I really like that. I don't remember what it's called.
Oh, ziti? No.
No.
Are you talking about ravioli?
No. They're long and they're tubes and they're full of cheese.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, they're
that's like good. The giant penne, but they're not penne. Yeah. I don't really know what they are.
Yeah, whatever that is. My grandpa would make that all the time. So good. I guess I could just ask him. I'm not gonna ask him. And
yeah, because sound like he's dead. Jesus.
Yeah, my favorite, I don't know, probably just magic, dude. I don't know. That stuff just really gets
me. Anytime I say, oh, this is referenced in magic and I have no idea about it, you do get really excited and talk a lot about it. So,
because yeah, I have a near encyclopedic knowledge of cards printed over the last 8 years. So I'm like, oh, it's finally useful. I finally can use this outside of sitting at a table with other nerds. Cool. I guess technically I'm still sitting at a table with
nerds. Other nerds. Yeah, yep.
But there's not cardboard 100%. In front of me. Yeah, so it's always exciting. So yeah, shout out to that ASMR Georgia just provided. Yeah, shout out to that sound.
I'm out of juice.
And speaking of being out of juice, thank you for listening to Broadcast from the Belfry. If you liked what you heard today, you can find us on anywhere you listen to podcasts, except for Google Play, because it's getting dissolved at the end of the year. So sorry. For me, as the only person that was probably using that as a podcast platform, if you could give us a or a subscribe, that'd also be really cool. It helps with algorithms that we don't really understand, but it helps apparently.
Truth.
If you'd like to contact us, you can do so on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram by searching Broadcast from the Belfry or following the link tree that's in the description-y bio thing at the bottom of this episode. Thank you to Marshall for making our music. Our intro song, you make us sound way more professional than we actually are. I'm forgetting.
Email us your Lovecraft things.
Email us if you have any thoughts on Lovecraft Country, any questions as a whole, if you just want to say hi. But specifically, if you have questions about Lovecraft, it'd be cool. And we'll review those at the end of Lovecraft Country or by emailing us at broadcastfromthebelfry@gmail.com. I think that's it. I'm pretty sure. Yeah?
Yep.
Alright, sweet. Well, thank you guys for listening. We appreciate it. We love you all.
I don't love everyone.
Oh, I do. What do we say to the kind, spaghetti-loving folk that listen to this podcast?
Thanks for listening, and stay saucy. Spooky. Yeah. Spaghetti saucy.
Spaghetti saucy penne sluts.